The greater excitement began very early in the morning when Peter went into Christopher's room and found matters in disorder there, and Christopher gone. He went hastily downstairs. Everywhere he hunted for Christopher, and everywhere Christopher was not to be seen. And then it was found that the strong, flea-bitten roan was missing also. That explained matters clearly enough. Christopher had fled. So Peter went bounding into the house and, as a matter of course, went straight to the head of the family. His eldest brother, Samson.
Samson, Chris is gone.
Gone?
I've looked everywhere, and he's not in the house. I went out to the barn, and the old roan is gone too. Do you think he took the horse and ran off?
Samson, that dark and somber man, listened to the terrible news with a look of agony in his eye.
It's the waiting. There never was a son of our father that could be a coward, but it was the waiting that killed him. But Peter, what will happen to Mother when she finds out?
She mustn't find out. It would be the death of her.
How can we keep it from her? Won't she miss Chris in 5 minutes? Doesn't she really love him more than she loves all the rest of us put together?
They stared at each other, unable to find a solution to this dreadful problem. In due course, the rest of the brothers gathered in a solemn conclave where each had a different opinion. Duncan was for rushing off single-handed, meeting with the famous Harry Maine, and destroying him in order that the shame of Christopher Royal should not be noised abroad.
You'd never have a chance against Maine. None of us would. And Chris would have simply died if he'd met him. Because the fella is a devil. The only language he understands really is the chattering of a fanned colt. But what's there in a death compared with the shame? No, I won't let you throw yourself away, Duncan. Well, what's to be done with Mother?
Go straight to her, Samson, and tell her the truth. That's the only way.
Go straight to her? I'd a lot rather go tell her that Chris is dead.
It's your business to talk to her. You're the oldest. And besides, do you think we could pull the wool over her eyes for 10 minutes? She sees through me as though I were made of plate glass, and I think that I'm as politic as the rest of you.
They considered Peter's advice, though bitter, a wise pill to swallow. And therefore Samson Royal went straight to his mother and found her already down in the garden, working with her own trowel with her usual energy. Samson helped his mother to her feet.
Mother, I'm sorry to say that Christopher seems to have left.
She waved the trowel at him.
Of course he has.
Samson stared.
Of course.
Dear Sammy, can't you understand that Christopher won't fight with Harry Maine right here in my home? But he's gone off to meet him.
Gone to meet him? Without saying goodbye to any of us?
Of course. Of course. Samson, you can see that he wouldn't want to trouble the rest of you and say goodbye in a melancholy way when he goes out to die.
But it doesn't seem like Christopher's way of doing things.
Do you really believe that you understand him?
No. I suppose that I forgot that he's his mother's son, after all.
Samson went back to tell the new idea to his brothers. They accepted this interpretation without any hesitation, for they were accustomed to taking the word of Mrs. Royal as the truth. And they went out to their work without further question. The morning mail brought further news to Mrs. Royal. It was a brief note from Harry Maine addressed to Christopher, and she opened it without hesitation.
Dear Royal, I'm going to be at Yates's place this evening. Will that do for you? I'll expect to hear from you there.
While she sat in a gloomy quandary over the note, there came a call from Georgia Lassiter on the telephone.
Hello?
Miss Royal, we've heard very, very odd news. That Christopher has left the valley just as Harry Maine came into it.
Ah, how cold was the voice of Georgia. What wonder, for she grew up in a family full of legends of war. 3/4 of her uncles and cousins died fighting for the lost cause of the Confederacy.
He simply made a meeting place with Harry Maine outside the valley. You couldn't expect him to want to shed blood on my doorstep, Georgia dear.
Oh, why didn't I think of that? Oh, but I've been wondering and terribly worried because I was afraid. Well, that's all gone. I'll never doubt again.
Mrs. Royal, left to herself, turned the problem over for the 1,000th time in her mind. Something led her up the stairs and into the attic to those old boxes where the worn clothes of the family had been stored for years. Not that there was ever much chance they would be needed, but because Mrs. Royal was a woman of system and thrift, And moreover, whenever she thought of giving the clothes away, something held her back. She opened the box where Christopher's things had been deposited, and it seemed to her as she lifted them out and looked them over that it was not a mere collection of clothes smelling of mothballs, but Christopher himself, resurrected and lying there preserved in her memory. She could remember with an odd and unhappy distinctness how he looked in his blue sailor suit that last day his father saw him on this earth. What were the thoughts of that stern spirit now as he looked down from the kingdom above and peered into the heart of the Craven?
Oh, Christopher, what have you done?
And here was the first pair of long trousers that made Christopher so inordinately proud. She could remember with what care he always hitched them up at the knees before he sat down. None of her other sons truly appreciated the graces of society as Christopher had. Not one of them had ever been so close to her. There had always been a feminine delicacy in the instincts of this lad that enabled him to look into her mind and know what she felt before she could express herself in words. When she looked forward to old age, she saw Christopher as a son and as a friend to lean upon. The rest of the world grew dim in prospect, but Christopher's gentle and wise heart glowed, a vision of sunshine.
Christopher, my light.
Now he was gone. He was already worse than dead, and she wished with a bitterness she could have closed the book of her thoughts when he reached his 20th year, say, the most admired and loved man to ever ride a horse down Royal Valley. Then there would have been in her heart to the end of her days a fixed worship of this gentle boy, a fixed belief in the great man he might have become. But now he was gone, filling her heart with naught save grief. She closed the box and hurried from the dimness of the attic with the ghosts of her sad thoughts about her. In the brighter sunshine of her own room, new courage and a new idea came to her. Death itself for Christopher seemed to her no tragedy now. It was only the desire to let him die bravely, or at least where no third person might see his cowardice. She caught up a pen and paper and wrote hurriedly upon it.
Dear Maine, I am waiting for you at the little cabin in the hollow above Emmett's. Come when you can. Christopher Royal.
Then she doubted, for it might very well be that Maine would question the genuineness of this handwriting. She hunted through her desk until she found a letter from Christopher. Then, with a resolute hand, she rewrote her note, making the letters as bold and firm and sweeping as the hand of Christopher himself. She addressed the note in the same manner. Then she called Wong, the cook. He was the only person in the household that would not think this a most suspicious affair. To him, she entrusted the note.
Wong, I want you to take the buggy and drive down the valley as fast as you can to Mr. Yates's saloon. Then leave this letter there. Do you understand? It's very important.
Presently, as she heard the wheels of the buggy grinding down the gravel of the driveway, she knew that Wong was gone, and that she had set in motion the wheels of death that must overtake her son before another 24 hours had spun away. In the meantime, she must wait, striving to close her eyes against the passing of time, and praying every moment with all her heart that Christopher would find in his soul enough courage to let him meet death as a man should meet it. She went down to her garden. There she could leave behind her most surely the thoughts of her boy.
Mr. Granger, where is Lurcher? He's always basking there on the terrace at this time of the morning.
Granger, the gardener, stood up from his work with the hoe.
Lurcher's gone. I called him for his breakfast, and he didn't come in. I whistled and hollered for him. You know that he never leaves the ranch, and so I'm afraid that something must have happened to him here.
Mrs. Royal's breath caught as she heard. Could it be that the strange dog indeed left the place and followed her boy with an animal's strange instinct for an approaching death? Christopher gave the big horse his head for 2 miles up the valley, and the big gelding thrust his head well out and down and proceeded to unlimber himself with a little artistic pitching. Christopher let him have his way because he rather enjoyed anything in the way of excitement that would take his mind from his wretched self. The struggle didn't last long. The bone-breaking grip of his knees and the iron of his hand upon the reins soon assured the roan that fighting was no use. The animal stopped and shook his head, as though partly bewildered. And at that moment, he received a cruel prick with the spurs, and his head was quickly straightened at a fence. Ears flattened, eyes trailing fire, mouth agape under the pull of the bit, he bolted straight at the loftiest part of the fence, and Christopher let him go. As he rode, he wondered grimly to himself what other man in Royal Valley would have put an untried mount at such an obstacle. Aye, but courage across fences was not what was needed in his life. Courage to face a fighting man was the thing. The fence rose sheer before him, and then the roan leaped into the air. His two trailing hind hooves clicked sharply against the upper bar. Coming down on the other side, they charged away across the field beyond. By the time they had come to Fisher's Well, where the road forked toward Emmett's on the right and toward Cluster Cannon on the left, the roan had had enough of such high life. He came back to a moderate canter and then to a soft, sweeping trot that brushed the miles away behind him with a wolfish ease. A miserable satisfaction rose in the heart of Big Christopher as he considered the action and the breathing of his mount. A few days on the road, and the roan would be in such condition that Harry Mayne, desperate rider and expert trailer as he was famed to be, would have much to do to keep up with such a pace as the fugitive could set.
Take us away, boy.
But then, even Harry Mayne could not fathom, surely, the problem now laying before him. And unless Christopher had a mind reader working against him, he felt confident he could lie in secure hiding among the tall, dark woods above Emmett's. After that, he would wait a number of days until it was certain that Harry Mayne was away from the trail. Then Christopher would ride down to a new country, and far off, where the name of Royal meant nothing, and his race of tall brothers remained unknown. He turned the roan onto the right-hand road and turned to look back down the valley, perhaps for his last look at it. He could see the lofty roof of the royal house looming above the distant trees, and nearer at hand a shadow slipped from one bush to another across the road.
Coyote.
Christopher turned his face forward again. When he was climbing the divide leading toward the upper ranges of the hills, he glanced back down the winding trail again. There was not much light. There were clouds enough to kill the stars, and behind the high-blown mist, the moon sailed in a pale gray canoe. But still, he found enough light to show him once more a shadow skulking from bush to bush behind him.
That's no coyote.
He drew rein at that and instinctively reached for his rifle. For since when had coyotes begun to trail lone riders? And the creature behind him was not half large enough for a wolf. After a moment, hearing nothing but the hiss of the wind through the willow by the creek, and seeing nothing but the hurried bobbing of the heads of the trees, he turned his face forward along the trail again.
What is it?
It worried him, for though wolves and bears were apt to trail men, all other animals were either unable to keep up with the pace of a horse, or else were too thoroughly afraid of the lords of creation to come near for any length of time. And so this small thing remained a mystery to him that troubled his mind as he toiled up the slopes, with the good horse bowing his head to the work. He reached Emmett's in the gray of the coming dawn and passed it, keeping well within the forest, so that only now and then could he see the lights of the little village twinkling dim and cold through the mist which lay pooled in the hollow. Beyond Emmett's, he rode up to the dell where that deserted cabin stood in which they had passed the vacation those years before. He could see to the right the hilltop from which he had sighted the big grizzly in the valley beyond, that grizzly which he had trailed for 3 days and nights before he caught up with it and finished its marauding life with a well-placed bullet. Now it was his turn to be hunted. He dismounted and, throwing the reins, he entered the cabin. It was far gone with moldering time now. Those years before, it had been small and simple enough, but now it was a complete wreck. A board of the flooring crunched away to rotten pulp under the weight of his stride as he entered. It was so damp, so dark, so utterly dismal that he felt half inclined to spend the night beneath the dank and dripping trees rather than in this place. And yet, when he thought of the matter, he could see that the more hopelessly ruined the shack, the more perfect his security in it. So he remained. Lighting a match, he looked around him. He noted the table leaning to the floor in a corner of the room, and the fallen branch of a great tree blown down in a storm that crunched its way through the rotten roof and showed its ragged butt as though even now ready to fall farther. Yes, the cabin was a complete wreck, but now he felt satisfied. It stood safe, safe from all men, and therefore dearer to him than any palace of a king. As he crossed the old brush-grown clearing again, the wind slashed and tugged at his slicker, and the rain cuffed his face with cold fingers. But in the dripping forest, he busied himself cutting a number of tender fir branches till he had gathered a great armful. These he carried back to the cabin, beat the water out of them thoroughly, and then built them into the foundation of a bed in the cabin. He laid down his meager blanket roll over them, and then he looked about to take care of the horse. By this time, the roan had cooled off so much that there was no danger of chilling him by removing the saddle. And now he remembered the little meadow higher up on the creek, surrounded by trees so tall and thick that it was amply fenced in against all manner of bitter weather.
Come on, boy. Let's get you some feed.
To this place he led the gelding. The tall grass bent in the wind over the matted remains of old crops around its roots. The dense trees shut out the cutting edges of the wind, and yonder lay the leaning rock, which stood out so far from the side of the mountain that it made a natural shelter against the rain, unless it drove in from the east. What better place could a hardy cow horse have asked? One that had fought its way through half a dozen of the range winters. He hobbled the roan here and left it contentedly cropping the grass beneath the shelter of the hanging rock. Then he turned back toward the cabin, and passing through the trees, he was sure that in the freshening daylight, a small animal darted from one tree to another. He could not be certain that he had actually seen any shape, however, and since the light had not strengthened to such a point he could effectually study a trail, he marched into the cabin. He pulled off his boots and lay down upon the damp bed. He lay very tired. Body and soul had been worn by his troubles and by the long ride he had made. Sleep dropped in a sudden wave over him and almost swallowed his senses. With a start, he sat up, a cold sweat on his forehead, for it seemed to him that something had been watching him from the entrance to the cabin. It couldn't be. He gritted his teeth as he clutched his rifle and started to his feet. Even if there was the dread of man in him, at least there was no dread of any other beast. He would be able to prove that he dared as much in the hunt as any human in the world. So he leaped to the door, and when he glanced toward the clearing through the growing glow of the dawn light, it seemed to him that he saw a subtly moving form melt among the shadows into the margin of the wood. He jerked the rifle to his shoulder. The range was very short. His hand was never steadier. He felt confident that he must have nailed the fugitive with the bullet. He felt so very confident, indeed, that he did not even go out to look for the dead, but turned back to the cabin and to his bed. He stretched himself out and allowed himself to drop securely toward slumber. He sat up again, this time with a racing heart. As he sat up, he was sure he had seen, from the corner of his eye, that a fugitive form had leapt through the doorway into the day outside. He had only a glimpse, but his hand moved lightning fast to snatch a revolver. He heard no sound to answer the shot. He rushed to the door, and once more all he saw was the dark and ominous face of the forest rising tall and deathly silent before him. He sprinted around the shack, thinking that the creature must have dodged out of sight by that route, but still there was no sign of it, high or low. As he stepped back inside, he leaned his broad shoulders against the wall of the shack. Alone in the shack, the dreadful thought came to Christopher that it was no animal of flesh and blood at all, but a phantom sent to cross his way with a foreboding of doom. He had no need of sleep after that. There was no trace of the white mist which had obscured the hollows and tangled among the forest trees as he was climbing the trail. All was bright sunshine, far brighter than the lowlands could ever know. So he began to cut for sign through the woods, But though he thought he found traces here and there, so thick lay the carpeting of pine needles everywhere beneath the trees that he could not make sure of anything he saw by way of foot impression upon the soil. And where the pine needles did not lie, grew rank, tall grass with the matted dead remains of other seasons entangled about the roots to such a degree that the tread of a horse upon it could hardly have been distinguished from the step of a bear as it curled upward again the moment the pressure of the step lifted. Then he came to a pause. The cry seemed to well up to his ears from every side. He made no effort to trace the beast by the cry, for the grim surety came to him that tracing would do no good. Twice he had tried the nature of this phantom with good powder and lead, and twice the thing had escaped from him unscathed. Perhaps it would have seemed a small affair to some, but to Christopher, whose nerves already stood on edge, and whose whole spiritual stamina seemed broken down by shame and grief and self-disgust, this was enough to carry away the last of his resolution.
I gotta find another place.
He determined upon leaving the cabin behind Emmett's as soon as possible and hunting down another hiding place deeper in the mountains. Some place, for instance, where the cheerless woods would not be standing so perilously close to him. He went to the roan at once, saddled it, rolled his blankets, and started forging through the pass that opened above him. It was a cheerful canyon after the depression of the hollow, and he enjoyed the keen morning sun that smoked between his shoulder blades. It was just such a day as leads to the dispelling of all foolish illusions. He followed the dim trail along the edge of a creek until the way turned into a shallow ford. He was in no hurry. He dismounted and examined the bottom of the ford to make sure that it was safe for the roan. The rocks at the bottom seemed firm and secure enough, and he led the gelding across. On the farther side, he paused once more, and doing so, he scanned the valley up which he had just been riding. It was very open and clear. There was hardly a stone big enough for a prairie dog to have hidden behind, and there was not the slightest sign of the haunting ghost wolf. He nodded to himself with satisfaction and turned to put his foot in the stirrup when he found himself looking straight into a pair of eyes, human eyes, watching him from close by. An Indian, so old that his wasted body could have illustrated the legend of Tithunus, and clad in such tatters that his half-naked body, his clothes, even the homely fishing rod he held, melted into the patchwork of the valley side with its bronzed rocks and spotted shrubs. And yet Christopher stood a little startled that he could have been so close to a man without noticing the existence of the other. That was before he studied the eyes of this stranger and saw them vacant with age. There was no more life in this withered creature than in a dying tree, say, or some blind growth that floats in the depths of the sea, untouched by the sun.
Do you have luck here, my father? Do the fish take the bait?
The ancient Indian looked at him without interest, and then, lifting his head, he glanced at the pale blue of the mountain sky.
The Great Spirit sends the fish and the fisher. Sometimes the fish are taken, and sometimes the fisher.
Christopher stared at him, certain he stood before something other than an ordinary Indian. Here was a man of such age that he must have ridden his ponies and taken scalps long before the repeating rifle had been dreamed of. Even the revolver was still an unheralded invention in the days of the youth of this chief. How much had been seen by the old man? Half the continent had first been explored and then fought for and conquered and peopled during the span of his existence. Christopher tried to fall in with the old fella's own phraseology.
However, the Great Spirit has favored men a little more than he has favored fish, you must admit.
How has he favored men?
He's given us brains.
To walk on the dry land. But the fish lives in the water. Can we follow him there?
He has only a thin stream or a little muddy pool for his life.
His rivers lead down to the ocean, my son.
Christopher stared. It was very odd to find so much mental agility in so dead a body as that which sat before him.
However, he has given us a soul, you know.
Look!
The chief scooped up some sand in his claw-like hand. how many grains of sand are here? But if all of them were the souls of men, only one of them all would come to the life of the sky people and stand before the face of the Great Spirit and ride his horses there and take scalps and live in happiness.
Only one?
Christopher grew enchanted by this voice from the past and this prophet of a dead creed.
But what about all the rest?
Some will die having done no great deed. For many men grow old, and they have done nothing greater than to skin a buffalo or to make an arrow. He let most of the sand sift away from his bony fingers. And there are a few who have fought like men and been strong and true, but in the last moment they turned coward before their enemies, and the enemies have taken them and split their heads with axes and taken off their scalps and left their souls to blow up and down the earth forever, like that leaf, never resting. Christopher turned and regarded the little spinning, twisting, drifting leaf with curiosity. The thought sent a thrill of coldness through him.
But suppose these men have fought bravely and been overcome in battle by numbers, but not with fear.
That cannot be, for the brave men cannot die in battle. It is only chance that kills them. And that is the Great Spirit leaning from the sky to take them because he has watched them too long and wished to have them close to him.
Then only cowards die.
Only the cowards. All these people have souls so that they may suffer. They see death always before them. It is curled up like a rattlesnake among the rocks. It stands in the darkness of the teepee and watches them like a hawk. It whistles for them in the wind. It beats on them in the hail and rain. It strikes for them in thunderstrokes. Cowards die always. Yes, some are brave in little dangers, but their souls turn to water when they see great odds before them. But it is always the thing we fear that kills us. Otherwise, nothing can take us from the earth except the hand of the Great Spirit.
Come, come. You will not treat all your friends and family so harshly, because I can guess that a great many of them died in battle.
All of my people and the families of my brothers have died in battle. They were all cowards.
Are you still sure of that?
Oh, yes.
Then I must say that the Great Spirit is a spendthrift to throw away so many good people and let their souls blow up and down the world.
I shall tell you about the Great Spirit. He is like you and me. We have seen 10,000 faces, but we have only one friend. And so it is with the Great Spirit. He has seen 10 million souls turn to powder and blow away in the wind. And only one is left. But that one is a bright soul and worth all the rest. And so the Great Spirit, when he has made sure that the one soul really shines, snatches it greedily up to him in the sky, and there they live happily together. As he spoke, he had shaken out the rest of the sand grains, and now he held up between his thumb and his forefinger only a single little fragment of quartz, transparent and with a gleaming thread of gold in it, so that it poured forth a stream of sparkles in the keen morning light. Christopher could not help being moved by such imagery.
But consider yourself, Father. Certainly no enemy has ever taken your scalp.
The other nodded at once, unoffended. And yet the Great Spirit has allowed me to grow old and thin as a blade of dried grass. That is true, but it is because he could not be sure. Sometimes I seem to shine, and sometimes I seemed dark and dull. He watched me in battle, and he saw me ride through the ranks of the Sioux as though they were the standing brush in the field. He saw me make their heads fall as a little boy with a stick makes the heads of the tall cornflowers bend. He saw me take many scalps and count many coups, and often his heart grew hot with joy and he stretched out his hand down from heaven so close that I could feel his fingers in the wind tugging at my hair. But always he drew his hands back again and waited and watched, for he could not be sure.
How could he have doubted?
With men, he knew I was brave. But listen, he held up a cautionary finger. Christopher, remembering his phantom in the hollow, shuddered a little. He could not help it. It is always there. The old man leaned his head to listen, as though to hear a terribly familiar music. It is always somewhere between me and the edge of the sky. Sometimes it is so far away that I do not hear it. Sometimes it holds its voice and crawls up to watch me. But it is always there. He nodded his head with a religious conviction.
But what is it, Father?
Christopher began to feel his flesh creep. It is the werewolf that has kept me away from the Great Spirit for all these years.
A werewolf?
There are two kinds of werewolves. A man turning into a wolf, or a wolf turning into a man. The ones which have been men and become wolves are only terrible for a short time, and then they become stupid. Then there are the wolves which cannot become men until they have killed the warrior marked out for them. He closed his eyes. When I was a little boy, I frightened the horse of Black Antelope, the medicine man, and he got a fall when the horse bucked. I was very happy. I danced and laughed with pleasure to see him in the dirt. But then I heard him shouting out of the dust cloud.
You! The werewolf is waiting to take you! May he take you soon!
I saw that he had known this for a long time, but the knowledge had been forced from his lips by his passion. Then I could remember, young as I was, that often I had seen wolves skulking near me. Fear jumped in my throat. You are a young man and a big man. Have you ever been afraid? He leaned forward a little and a cruel flame appeared in his eyes as he scanned the face of Christopher. Then he leaned back, nodding. You will understand what I'm saying. A little chill passed through Christopher as he saw that his secret lay plain before this terrible old wizard of the mountains. When I knew that there was a werewolf waiting for me, I did not fear men. If the Great Spirit meant a werewolf to inherit my soul, then I could not die until that one wolf reached me, if he were able. Therefore, I laughed at men. In battle, I knew their bullets could not touch me. I went into the fight singing my songs, and the Sioux became women before me. They turned their backs upon me, and I shot my arrows between their shoulder blades. I became a great man in my tribe, but I never hunted at night. And after dark, I stayed in my teepee until one cold winter night, a wolf put its head through the flap of my teepee and snarled at me. The next day, I saddled my best pony and fled to the south and left my squaws and my children behind me, for I felt the time had almost come and the wolf readied to take me. He was a brown wolf, young and strong. If I had stayed, the wolf would not have dared to face me. I should have rushed out into the night and fought with it, though I carried nothing but a knife. But I was afraid. And the moment that fear lays a whip on our backs, we cannot stop running. So I have been fleeing all the days of my life. And the wolf follows me. I saw him only so long ago as the waning of the old moon, when it was like the paring of a fingernail in the sky. He is a gray wolf now. His back is arched, and his belly is tucked up with age. One of his fangs is broken. With the other, he still hopes to cut my throat. But someday, I shall hear him and leave my fire and go out in the darkness and call to him. With my knife in my hand, I shall fight him and kill him.
And when he is dead, the Great Spirit, who has waited and watched so long for me, will snatch me up in his fingers and make me happy forever.
The Indian ended his tale with a glitter in his eyes. At the sound of the wolf, the eyes of the chief instantly struck blank. The fishing rod trembled in his hand. When Christopher had given the old fella half the tobacco in his pouch, he rode up the trail again. But he was a very thoughtful man. Of course, the whole matter lay plain to him. He could see how the momentary malice of the old medicine man, Black Antelope, poisoned all the following years of this man's life. Yet he could not smile at the superstition. He had lost the calloused hardness of self-assurance, and into his opened soul strange thoughts dropped, like those falling stars which show the blackness of the heavens. When he reached the ridge of the divide, he looked across a far prospect, with the mountain crests tossed up as rough and crowded as storm waves on a sea.
Why should I flee into this unknown region? If anything supernatural follows me, better to face it in a place I know.
Suddenly he turned and rode down the trail up which he had just passed. Not that I would have you think he took as true all that the Indian told him, or any of it for that matter. But no matter how sophisticated we may become, superstitions will leave a trace and a taint within our souls. So it was with Christopher. And he was like the man who sees the moon over his left shoulder and scorns the superstition of bad luck, but cannot keep a chill from passing down his blood. Whatever haunted him, he was sure it had been a living creature of flesh and blood. He was sure, and yet a coldness began spreading through his body, his soul. It happened that just now, halting the roan for breath, he looked back and saw, or thought he saw, a shadow behind the shadow of a bush. He took quick aim.
Come on, boy.
He spurred the roan furiously back to the spot. He saw nothing there. He dismounted and hunched down to examine the ground. It was a soft sand which would have registered the impression even of a falling leaf, and yet there was not a trace upon it. He stood up and mounted again, with a prickling sense of dread coursing up and down his back. Yet there had been, he felt, an infinite amount of truth in what the old Indian had told him. The fears that we flee from are those which will eventually master us. Those which we face shrink away from us in turn and become as nothing. So he went straight back to the deserted and moldering cabin in the hollow, which he had left so gladly that morning. You will say that he should have carried his philosophy a stage further and gone back to his home to outface the first impelling terror, the dread of Harry Maine and his guns. But to tell the truth, his mind did not dwell upon Harry Maine. This other uncanny fear had overmastered him, and its problem, to be scorned and mocked by his consciousness, continually lurked in the back of his brain. When he got to the cabin, it was mid-afternoon. A rabbit had lifted its head above a rock a quarter of a mile above the edge of the pines of the hollow, and he tried his Colt with a snapshot. When he rode to the rock, he found the rabbit's body secure enough, the brains dashed out by the bullet. No, his hand had not lost its cunning or its surety. He cleaned the rabbit on the spot and carried it on toward the cabin for his dinner. But as he went, the darkness of his brain increased. He had fired at the rabbit with no more skill and surety than at the ghost thing which had been hunting him in a wolfish shape, and yet the other twice escaped. The moment he entered the dark circle of the pines, he regretted his return to the spot, for the stretching shadows that covered him darkened his spirit more than his eyes. He cooked the rabbit and ate it, but it was with a forced appetite, and he went about his preparations for the night mechanically. His heart was not in them. He had to urge himself forward continually with the remembered words of the old chief. He decided, as the evening began, that he would try his nerves in the forest itself while the darkness gathered, and so he sat down beneath the trees and lighted his pipe. It suddenly occurred to him that the glowing light in the bowl of the pipe would be like a guiding lantern to direct any danger toward him, and to blind his eyes against all drifting shadows. such as the form of an old gray wolf, its back arched with age, and its belly gaunt, and with one broken fang, and the other capable of splitting open the throat of a man.
Why did I come back here?
Now he wished mightily that he had continued on his way through the unknown mountains to the north and to the east. But he would not saddle the roan for a night journey. It was not because he pitied the weariness of the horse, but because he dreaded the trip through the solemn woods, worse than death. He left the trees at last and went into the cabin. He found that he was crossing the clearing with a slinking gait, his head down, and though he forced himself to walk erect, his heart he could not lift. So he came to the cabin and laid down his blanket roll there. Across the moon, volleys of high-blown clouds swept and crossed the threshold of the cabin with waves of light and shadow. The whole world now appeared an eerie place indeed, and a setting in which all that was wild and strange might happen. He thought of the old Indian and his lifetime passed in the midst of just such dread as this, reinforced by a superstition that turned fear into a thing as concrete as a pointed gun. What unbelievable force of nerve and courage maintained the old man so long, living as he did in the lonely middle of the mountains, waiting for death in a strange form? Christopher pulled a pile of branches that supported his bedding to a corner of the cabin from which he could watch the door. A window in the wall provided an opening from which he could be spied upon, but a ragged fragment of a board hung nailed across it. No wolf could jump through. He smiled at his own conceit, but you may be sure there was no mirth in his smile. It seems strange that Christopher Royal could have been brought to such a nervous state because a lurking shadow crossed his path a few times. But undoubtedly he remained unstrung chiefly by his interview with the old Indian. However that may be, he had almost reached the point of hysteria, listening to imaginary sounds and watching the alternate dimming and brightening of the moonlight on the floor. Then came a thing that blinded him with fear. Beyond the door, in the clearing, he heard the unmistakable though soft crackle of a twig beneath an approaching, stealthy foot. All of this time he had been telling himself with a breathless insistence that there was nothing at all in his dread beyond a sort of fear of the dark, and that when the morning came he would simply mount the roan and ride away from this wretched nightmare in spite of the advice of the crazed Indian. Now came the positive proof that a living creature moved in the clearing, a creature that guessed his presence in the cabin, for otherwise why should anyone or anything stalk the cabin with such care? Too paralyzed even to think of clutching the colt at his hip, Christopher stood up against the wall opposite the door, just in time to see a shadow cross the dim moonlight that passed the threshold of his door. It was not like the shadow of a wolf. Christopher suddenly glanced up and found himself peering into the face of Harry Mayne. He had never seen that famous man in the flesh before, but he could have recognized him even by dimmer light than this as the brother of Cliff Mayne, the man he killed by luck rather than by valor. The revolver held in the hand of Harry Mayne quickly steadied on its target.
It's all right, kid. I'm here to finish you off, but there ain't any need for me to rush around about it. I understand everything. You lost your nerve waiting for me and you come up here in a blue funk. I understand all of that, and I'm gonna wait till you've had a chance to get a hold of yourself before I tackle you with a gun. You can depend on that, because I do keep my promises.
And he dropped his revolver back into the holster. An instant later, he was startled with a thrill of cold fear, for he had seen Christopher standing against the wall, a very picture of abject, helpless, frozen terror only a moment before. And now he heard something he wasn't expecting.
Are you the wolf? You?
Am I the wolf?
Mayne retreated toward the doorway behind him.
What in the name of heaven do you mean? Are you crazy, Royal?
And perhaps no man in the world ever looked closer to insanity than did Christopher at that moment. For his life, which had come to a stop, began again. And as it began, a flare of warmth and fiery self-confidence flamed in his eyes and dilated his nostrils and made his breast heave. Under the dreadful shadow of an unearthly fear, he had quite forgotten that it was the original dread of Harry Mayne that forced him from his home and into the mountains. He had quite forgotten that. Now there remained before him only the overpowering horror of a supernatural enemy. To such an extent was this true that as he had been standing against the wall, he had thought to himself the words of the Indian.
There are two kinds of werewolves. A man turning into a wolf, or a wolf turning into a man.
And to be sure, if one looked closely at the handsome dark features of Harry Mayne, one could not help finding something decidedly wolfish in his appearance. There was a smallness and a brightness in the eyes, which were moreover set abnormally close together, that gave his face a touch of animal cunning. And the bulge of his jaw muscles added a rather brutal strength to the lower part of his face. He looked as brown, too, as a creature capable of living without any covering other than its own pelt. But Christopher was not ready at that moment to mark small differences and peculiarities. What mattered to him was that he had been more than half expecting the dreadful apparition of a wolf or a wolf man in the doorway. And instead, here was a man, a mere being of flesh and blood like himself. And that was why Christopher laughed at the sight of that famous and dreadful Harry Mayne. He laughed out of pure relief and excess of thankfulness and joy that, after all, he was to be tested by something less than supernatural power.
By eternal heaven, it's only Harry Mayne!
Harry Mayne had been fairly certain that this fellow was insane a moment before, but he rather doubted it now after facing Christopher for a moment, and he began to wish that he had kept his Colt in his hand. Only Harry Mayne. A very singular remark, surely, concerning the most terrible of all those practiced gunfighters who rode the mountain desert. It literally took the blood from the heart of the man of might and threw it all into his face.
And what more do you want to have on your hands than Harry Mayne?
What more? Why, if there were a half dozen of you, I should still laugh at you, Mayne. I should still laugh at you.
Harry Mayne listened and positively gaped with childish wonder and with horror also, for he could not feel that this was stage playing. There was a ring of such tremendous sincerity and honesty about the words of Christopher that a more skeptical man than Harry Mayne would have been convinced.
I'm about to finish you off, Royal. I don't know that it's any pleasure to me to have to kill you, but you took that out of my hands and left me no choice in it. You murdered poor Cliff.
That was a perfectly fair fight.
Fair? Why, everybody knows that Cliff was only a kid.
He was 2 years older than I am.
The heat of Harry Mayne increased.
You ain't gonna be allowed to sneak out of that blood this way, Chris Royal.
Sneak out? Sneak out? Well, man, I'll tell you an honest fact. I was never so glad of anything as I am at the sight of you tonight.
The hell you are.
The gunfighter stared more closely at Christopher Royal. It was true. Yes, it was very true. He would have been the worst sort of a blind man not to see that Christopher meant all that he said and had not the slightest fear of his famous antagonist.
Oh, yes. But since you seem a decent fellow, Harry, I rather hate to have to send you after your brother.
Oh, do you hate to do that? I'm ready to tear your heart out if you've got the guts to stand up to me.
Another cross passed like a shadow over the face of Christopher. And then he shrugged his shoulders as though to get rid of the idea.
Well,
I'm thinking of the long stretch after I've dropped you, Harry. As drop you, I surely shall. And besides, I'm wondering if we wouldn't both be happier if we had sunlight instead of moonshine for our work.
Moonlight is good enough.
Christopher nodded.
You're getting nervous, I see. And if that's the case, why, we'll have it out now, man, of course. I suppose you might become rather a nervous wreck if you had to wait until morning.
To the devil with your coolness!
Me turn into a nervous wreck? I ain't got a nerve in my body. And when it comes the time for the guns to work, I'm gonna show you I mean what I say.
You shoot very well, I hear.
That's best told by them that ain't no longer got a voice in this here world.
By the dead, you mean? You've killed a great many people. I've heard that you've killed all of 14 men, Mayne.
Up to tonight, not counting the greases, yes. And you'll be the 15th white man.
I shall.
Christopher looked at Harry Mayne and then smiled brightly and carelessly, as though to announce that he did not care to argue such an absurd suggestion. and a little mist of perspiration, a cold sweat came out upon the forehead of Harry Maine.
All right, if you're not afraid to wait until morning.
Do you think that you can bluff me out? I'll have your nerves all frazzled out if you wait that long in the same house with me.
Will you?
Christopher stretched his arms out luxuriously.
Well, you watch me.
He threw himself down on the bed, took a turn in the blanket, and was almost instantly asleep, leaving Harry Maine standing by the door, with the killing power still gathered in his face, and a strangely empty and foolish feeling in his heart. It must be admitted that it was a most peculiar situation for Harry Maine. He had most certainly prophesied to himself that Christopher Royal, in spite of the shooting of Cliff, had turned yellow when he started up toward the higher mountains, and with that sense of surety supporting him, Harry Maine proceeded with a sort of contemptuous carelessness on the trail of revenge. He had never started out on a manhunt without feeling that he was superior in his skill with guns to any other man on the range. And now, this surety had been snatched out of his hands. He sat down and watched the pale, slow hand of the moonlight stretch across the floor and find the hand and then the face of Christopher. He stood up and leaned over the sleeper and saw that he was smiling in the midst of a happy dream. No wonder that Maine scratched his unshaven chin in great anger and perturbation. Such coolness was absolutely inexplicable to him, because it never occurred to him that Christopher had been existing in this cabin under the shadow of a fear so much more awful than that of any human being that it made even the hostile presence of Harry Maine not a terror, but an actual comfort. Having no key to the situation, Harry Maine began to feel that so far from having reached a craven fugitive, he had come up with the bravest man he had ever known. But to have fallen asleep in the presence of the gunfighter, the great and celebrated Harry Maine, that surely was a thing not to be believed. But sleeping, that lad most certainly was. Why then had Christopher left the valley? Simply because he wished to take the ugliness of battle away from the vicinity of his home? It seemed a most hollow sham and pretext to Harry Maine at the first, but now he began to believe that there must be something to it. He began to regard Christopher Royal more closely, and there was much about him that deserved the narrowest scrutiny. He watched the heaving of the high-arched chest while the young fellow slept. He regarded the wide and smooth slope of the shoulders and the strength of the jaw, and above all, the long-fingered hands. Men said that there was both infinite might and great speed in those hands, and Harry Maine, who was an expert in such affairs, could well believe it. The weight of a colt, for instance, would be no greater than that of a feather to the power of this man, and the round wrists and the tapering fingers promised the most flashing and dazzling speed of execution. Now it seemed to Harry Maine at about this time that the hours of the night were marching along with a very painfully slow step, and that the morning lingered with disgusting persistence beneath the edge of the eastern sky. He himself tried to lie down and to rest, but when he had stretched himself out in a resolute composure and closed his eyes, it always seemed to Harry Maine that his terrible young companion was slowly opening his eyes and then peering sidewise and then sitting up and reaching for a gun. At that point in his imaginings, Harry Maine would be snatched out of a semi-slumber and sit up with a jerk, only to find Christopher Royal sleeping most peacefully. Two or three times this was repeated, and at last Maine abandoned all attempts at resting. He stood by the door, or he walked up and down beside it, watching a pale mist that had boiled across the face of the moon and that was now gathering under the heads of the great forest trees. Frequently, however, he had to drag himself away from his thoughts and peer through the open door at young Christopher. And rage began to grow up in the breast of Harry Maine, for he felt that by a low trickery, Christopher Royal was enjoying a heartening and strengthening rest, whereas he, Harry Maine, who entered that house with the drop on the man he wanted and who surrendered that advantage willingly because he did not choose to murder but preferred to fight, He, Harry Mayne, walked up and down through the night fog and wondered what the devil ever entangled poor Cliff with this cold-nerved devil of a boy. But why not end the matter, now that there was no eye to watch? Mayne strode through the door with the Colt ready in his hand, but when he leaned over the sleeper, his finger withdrew its weight from the trigger. Once before, and long ago, just such a crime as this had attracted Harry Mayne, and on that occasion, he had not resisted temptation. But he had long since vowed that he would never have another such stain upon his conscience. So he went back to the door, stealthily, without making a sound, as he thought. And then turning around, he found the eyes of the supposed sleeper fixed steadily upon him. It was far from a pleasant experience for Mayne. And then Christopher sat up.
It was better not to do that.
I see that you're all shot to pieces, Mayne. And look here, if you want to postpone this business until the nerves have had a chance to settle down again, of course I'm agreeable to that. I don't want to hurry you ahead, you understand?
Hurry me ahead? Hurry me ahead? Why, if the daylight would only come, I'd polish you off in half a second.
Polish me off.
Christopher stood up and stretched forth his arms.
Well, Mayne, the day has begun.
What?
It's a thick mist. We often have them in this hollow. And that's what blankets the sun away. But look here. It's 7 o'clock. And let me know, old fellow, if you want to fight now or after breakfast.
There was such a world of good humor in his voice that Harry Mayne felt his heart shrink into a cold, small knot.
Now. You can bring in the gun work now. I'll be contented. But damn me if I'll wait for another 5 minutes to play the nurse to you.
Nurse? Well, well. The odd thing about it all, from my viewpoint, is that when I left the valley, I was actually afraid of you, old fella. Frightened to death of you. And now, as a matter of fact, I'm almost sorry that I shall have to turn loose a gun upon you.
Harry Mayne lowered his head a little for the purpose of scowling out beneath his gathered brows at the other, when he suddenly realized that no facial expressions were apt to daunt the very composed self-sufficiency of this young man.
Royal, when you left the valley, it wasn't to meet me up here. I don't know why you sent the letter, but I know that you never intended to meet me here.
What letter?
What letter? Why, the one where you told me that you'd be waiting for me in this cabin. The one that the chink brought down to Yates's place for me.
What?
It took the breath of Christopher to hear this. Certainly, he had dispatched no such letter, and there was no one in the world who knew where he intended to hide himself with the exception of his mother. But could she have done such a thing and betrayed him to his enemy? Then, in a blinding flash, he understood everything, and the prayer which she must have breathed to have her son dead rather than shamed. Her blind hope, too, that when the crisis came, he might find a mysterious strength to meet the emergency. And he had done so. For whether he could master Harry Mayne or not, he could not tell, but master himself, he certainly had. So he looked up again to Mayne.
You've guessed the facts. I was afraid of you when I left.
Then what happened?
Something that you wouldn't understand. There's no use in trying to talk about it or to explain.
I'd like to judge that for myself.
I'll tell you this. After what has happened to me up here, I feel as though there's no real harm that can be done by a bullet.
All right. I guess that's beyond me.
And there is a bit of blue sky for you. It's broad enough day. And I suppose that we have to go through with this thing.
We do.
Notwithstanding that I wasn't at fault with your brother.
You?
I give you my word of honor, Mayne, that I tried to back out of that fight. I didn't want his blood on my hands. I didn't want to fight with anybody, as a matter of fact.
Harry Mayne listened with a thoughtful frown. And again, he felt the transparent honesty of this youth and felt a shudder go through him.
That ain't what matters. The only fact that counts is that you stood up to poor Cliff and killed him. And now everybody expects me to stand up to you and kill you, or do my best. And that's what I'm here for.
I understand. Your reputation for being invincible is worth more to you than your life. You've got to risk that to protect your good fame. Well, there's nothing I can say to that.
No, there ain't anything you can say. But are you ready?
Ready.
They walked out of the little cabin side by side.
It ain't much better than moonshine, though.
Mayne regarded the fog which hung in dense clouds through the trees.
We'll have to stand close to each other with our guns, old-timer.
Yes, that seems logical. But by heaven, kid, you're the coolest hand that I ever had to shoot at. We'll take 10 paces.
All right. Which way?
You stand here. I'll measure off the distance.
He stalked 10 strides away, halted, and spun about toward Christopher.
Are you ready, Royal?
Ready.
No matter what doubts had passed through the mind of Harry Mayne during the long hours of the night, they seemed to disappear now that he faced his foe in the open. It seemed to Christopher that the very body of the other man swelled with passion. A gathering battle fury glittered in the eyes of the gunfighter. He tensed like a bull terrier that seems to have a tenfold power poured into it by the mere chance to bare his teeth at an enemy. As for Christopher, he felt no passion, and certainly least of all did he feel fear. The fury rising in the other would have appalled him beyond words only the day before, as he well knew. But now he stood possessed of a perfect calm, a cool indifference. And though he stood on the ground at point-blank range from this proved manslayer, he had the attitude of one who looks on a strange scene from a great distance. Instead of fear, out of that calmness a great sense of superior might flowed through him. He looked at the terrible Harry Mayne and looked down on him. He remembered what the Indian said, and of how, as a young brave, he careened through the ranks of the enemy laughing at their bullets because he knew a stranger and more deadly fate than mere bullets or arrows could deal out to him. Christopher Royal shared the same knowledge. As he stared at Harry Mayne, he could not help wondering where that other and haunting shadow might be. Was it not ever present, watching the man marked down for it? And the instant Harry Mayne died, would not that devilish film of a creature snap at his heels once more?
Harry,
go for your gun!
Mayne trembled with a dreadful eagerness.
Go for your gun, kid. I give you the first chance.
Like a wrestler, Mayne offered his hand openly to a weaker foe. But Christopher merely smiled.
Go for your gun!
I want to ask you for the last time to think the thing over, will you? I don't fear you, Mayne. But there's no reason I should try to kill you, and there's no reason why you should kill me. Do you think that you will ever be taunted for not having butchered me? No, people know you too well, and your record is too long.
My record is a fighting man's record. I'm no damn chattering jay like you. I'll give you warning, Royal.
I've heard your warning, and I take it. But I won't go for my gun first.
What?
I mean what I say. Make the first move if you will. I'll never shoot except in self-defense, man.
By heaven, your blood is on your own head for being a fool. I offer you the free chance. There ain't nobody here to report it on you.
Except one's conscience. And that's enough.
A sudden shudder went through the body of Christopher at the wolf's call. It seemed that the other noted it.
That varmint's gonna yell again in a minute. He's got something cornered. He'll yell again, and when he yells, that'll be the signal for us, Royal. You agree?
Yes, I agree to that. He'll howl a death yell for one of us.